and welcome to Dealcast, the M&A podcast. I'm Juliana Needham. Amid a fractious geopolitical environment, how are global antitrust practitioners navigating a seemingly delicate balance between domestic policy agendas on one hand and traditional antitrust arguments on the other? Well, someone who's working at the forefront of developments in international antitrust is Jen Mellott. She's the managing partner at Freshfields in Washington and also works at Freshfields Brussels office. And she advises clients on both US and EU competition law, so is well placed to provide insight into what's going on in different jurisdictions. Jen has represented companies including Hewlett Packard Enterprise, Adobe, Apple, Siemens, Starbucks and AstraZeneca. She spoke to Merger Markets Global Chief Regulatory Editor Ruben Miller. They talked about whether foreign direct investment is increasingly being used as a political tool, the role of lobbyists in getting approval for a deal, and where state attorneys general fit into the picture.
Hi, Jen. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's a true pleasure to have you on here.
Just happy to be here.
You are very much a woman in the trenches and, you know, dirty hands. You're in front of the agencies. You're representing global clients. This is really exciting. And I wanted to start the podcast talking a little bit about what the current state of affairs and how that compares to historical examples. So clearly, the last decade or so of antitrust has been pretty wild. And it feels like the true pendulum is swinging back and forth, but that's to some degree an outsider's perspective looking at this. So I wanted to just take a moment and ask you a little bit about what we're seeing in Trump 2.0. How is it similar? How is it different than what we saw during the Biden era? And how does it differ than the first time around when Trump originally came to office?
Yeah, Ruben, I mean, and it really is, that is the question. And I think, you know, January, new year, good time to sort of look back and think, you know, we're a year into this. What have we seen? And, you know, at the start of Trump 2.0, once we got leadership in place at the DOJ and FTC, we saw a lot of speeches about what was called America First antitrust. And this was kind of the policy description for how antitrust was going to look under Trump 2.0. And, you know, I think you could think of that as sort of a shift. But my view is that it's less of kind of a bold new direction and more of a continuation of this kind of blending of antitrust and broader policy goals that really, you know, started under the Biden administration and was a driver of a lot of the things that people were talking about in terms of antitrust enforcement over those 4 years. So if you go even further back, you know, kind of pre-2020, you have antitrust decisions, not just in the US by the DOJ and FTC, but really around the world made looking at what was called the consumer welfare standard. So whatever jurisdiction you're in, whatever your problem is, at the bottom line, you're sort of asking, is this deal, this conduct, is it good for consumers or will it harm consumers? And you know, you use economic evidence and documents and you get to an answer there. And that was kind of how antitrust lawyers in our little bubble thought about the world. Then we had the Biden administration where we really start to see this proliferation of the DOJ and the FTC thinking about antitrust as more of this like broad, flexible tool that you can apply to all kinds of policy goals. So you can use antitrust and get at labor issues and at healthcare issues and at concentration in tech sector issues that, you know, go to the way that news is deployed. You know, all of these things, you can use antitrust as a way to get at that. And when I think about, okay, what is America First antitrust? It's just a Republican flavor of that same blending of policy goals with antitrust enforcement. The difference is that now we're talking about Trump 2.0 policy goals instead of Biden policy goals. So, you know, you still have not just base consumer welfare standard like you did previously. Now you have consumer welfare standard, but blended with still labor issues, because that's kind of continued across the jurisdiction, across the administrations. But things like protection of small businesses, national security, supply chain resiliency, use of AI and algorithms. So whatever the Trump administration is trying to achieve, antitrust is one of the tools in the toolkit to do that. Now, what has changed for me is you have to layer on top of that sort of policy-oriented shift, what I will maybe call the kind of general chaos that defines the Trump administration, which means policy goals can be less clear-cut. They can shift from one day to the next, one person to the next. So you also have that kind of uncertainty built into this that can make it, you know, really difficult to know in a particular investigation or particular deal how it's going to be perceived, what kind of policy stories are going to resonate, what legal framework is going to apply. So, you know, we live in a time in Trump 2.0 where certain things have gotten a lot easier. Certain things remain really challenging, I think, for companies that are trying to do transactions, that are trying to make their way through investigations.
So, Jen, what does that look like in practice for someone in your seat? You have clients that come to you and say, hey, we're thinking about making this deal happen. Do you then apply a screen where you're saying, well, your industry touches on this agenda point for the Trump administration? We're going to get smart on that and try and craft a narrative where it makes sense and helps them achieve that objective. I mean, how much has your job changed from, you know, looking at market share numbers to, okay, where's the nexus with the agenda here? I mean, how much of that is done by the antitrust attorneys saying, hey, this is our angle, this is how we're going to make this resonate within the Trump administration?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Ruben. And I think, so maybe it's easier to start with what's the same. It is still the case that your first line of defense and your most important line of defense for any deal is the antitrust economic story. So as we always have, we start with the market shares, the concentration, how are customers going to react to the deal? What do your documents look like? What do your ordinary course documents look like? You know, and just building that story in the same way we always would of what is the antitrust risk here? What kind of transactional protections do you need? What is this process likely to look like? But what's different is we then layer over that this sort of policy conversation. And again, that's something, you know, that's not new for the last 12 months. That's something we've been doing for the last year or last 5 years, and try to think about kind of what is the narrative that ties all of that together. And the other piece that really complicates this is something else that's changed a lot in the last couple of years is that this kind of merger of policy and antitrust is not specific to the U.S. It's a global phenomenon. So we see the EC, the CMA, the SAMR in China, all of these regulators thinking about antitrust as something that should be aligned with broader policy aims. So in the EU, you might see that as antitrust should be aligned with ESG initiatives and climate change initiatives, for example. In the UK, you see right now a real focus on being pro-business and being kind of a destination for companies. And so a lot of antitrust enforcement is trying to align with that. And so to me, in the type of deals I do, the thing that is often the most challenging is thinking about what is that narrative that is coherent and resonates globally, because obviously you can't, you know, kind of go around in a deal and say, this deal will create a US champion and a European champion and protect Chinese national security and be great for the South African economy. Like, you know, that's just not credible. What I would not have done 5 years ago that I do a lot more of now is working with the business, company leadership, sometimes kind of public affairs teams within the business to think about how to craft that narrative. And it's really important that that's done prior to signing, because if it looks like a post hoc rationalization, it's not helpful. It's not going to resonate. It needs to be something that really shines through your pre-signing documents, your comms to your shareholders, your comms to your employees. All of that needs to kind of follow this, this narrative that you develop. But if you can do that right, that is something that can help, I think, smooth the path for a lot of deals by aligning your antitrust story, which is still the most important thing and you still need, with this kind of broader policy story.
Jen, you mentioned ESG considerations at the EC.
That, in my mind, comes in direct tension with some of the considerations that we've seen at the U.S. agencies, where the eradication of DEI has been put on the table as stakes for a merger to proceed. How do you reconcile those two narratives, and what tools are available for parties that are trying to make those considerations land with these regulators that have diametrically opposed objectives here?
Honestly, it is a really complicated area right now, because there's kind of two things happening at once that are in tension. One is, you know, people have probably been following the Kroger-Albertsons merger that was blocked in the Biden administration, but there's ongoing litigation in that case about the efforts covenant, whether the remedies that were proposed to the agencies met the level that was required. And that has driven parties sort of back to a world where there is a lot of interest in being very, very specific within your efforts covenants about what you're committing to do. Because if a deal does fall apart, you want to make sure you're protected on the back end from someone saying, you know, you should have divested X, Y, and Z, but you only committed to divest X. But on the other hand, you know, what we saw in the Biden administration and has continued now is that there are some kind of creative remedies, creative requirements, not just in the U.S. We see some of this in the U.K., but in the U.S. in particular, there remains this kind of specter, as you're saying, that you could have potentially a commitment to not have DEI policies, things like that. I am not seeing remedies that incorporate those kinds of things, but you could perceive in this administration a world where something like that happens. And so you do need to retain some flexibility to be able to deal with an issue that comes up that's sort of unanticipated if you're thinking about just the basic antitrust world. And so I think, you know, when I look at what parties are doing with respect to their transaction agreements, I mean, I think there is a real driver toward being as clear as possible, especially if you're agreeing to like a hell or high water with a materiality cap, making sure what that cap is, what those limits are very, very clear. It used to be the case that any kind of a behavioral commitment, like we'll get rid of our DEI policy, that was so rare that you would very often agree a hell or high water that was a very specific cap on asset divestitures, but basically said you'd accept whatever behavioral commitments come your way. Now, I think parties are a little bit more nervous about that because behavioral commitments could encompass a sort of broad spectrum of things, and maybe you're okay with some of those and maybe you're not. And something I would add here that is increasingly relevant is it's not just the antitrust review that you have to navigate through. We have had in the past 5 years a proliferation of these foreign direct investment regimes, and they don't just cover kind of defense national security type deals. They cover tech deals, they cover healthcare deals, they cover all kinds of sectors where FDI is actually the easier place for a country if it wants to impose some kind of a behavioral obligation to shoehorn that in, because these regimes are incredibly flexible. And so you do have to take a minute, I think, when you're negotiating a deal and think, okay, here's in the standard world what I think will happen here. But what are all of the other things about this sector, these parties, what they're doing for this country, for that country, that could become relevant here? And what are the things that I could be asked to do? And it's important that you know, talk to people who are on the ground in the trenches in all those jurisdictions and understand the current state, because it's, you know, it's changing all the time. And you're crafting an SPA, if it's going to be a 12-month or an 18-month SPA, that builds in the flexibility you need to say yes or no if those demands come across your desk. But it's a really complicated question. And I think right now the trend is probably toward more specificity rather than less. But there's a lot of procedural uncertainty. There's a lot of outcome uncertainty, and having the right level of flexibility in your SPAs is really the trick.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We've kind of talked around this without saying the word politicization of antitrust, but you know, for shorthand, I'll use it. I'm not putting words in your mouth, but you know, there is clearly from Trump 1.0, and then I believe the Biden administration opened the door for whole of government politicization of the antitrust process. And coming back to that question about what does America First antitrust look like? Has the antitrust bar fully digested that there are certain sectors, or the antitrust bar, the deal-making community, are there certain sectors that stand out as, okay, this, we're touching on a sensitive nerve here, we're going to have to be especially careful, we're going to have to craft this narrative early? I've been kind of hung up on this question, and I've asked a number of sitting officials in Trump 2.0, what does America First antitrust look like? And often the answer is, it's what affects consumers' pocketbooks, right? It's the price of groceries. It's the price you pay at the pump. It's things that the consumer can very clearly say, hey, this merger is going to be harmful for my ability to pay for this. So I wonder if there's any clear sectors that you would say, okay, we can wade in here, but we're touching on a sensitive nerve. Have you identified anything that, you know, really stands out at you as a priority for enforcers these days?
Yeah, I mean, I think every administration is going to have priorities in terms of the sectors that it's enforcing. You know, I do think there was in the Biden administration and continues in this administration to be an interest in those sectors that sort of will touch pocketbook issues. But I also think in this administration, we have seen and will continue to see a focus on tech, especially on AI. I mean, and that, again, that's not specific to the U.S. We see competition regulators all over the world very focused on what the implementation and proliferation of AI is going to mean across a lot of sectors. You know, healthcare is going to remain very in focus. And I think, you know, industries where there's sort of a American labor component are going to continue to be in focus. And this is, you know, it's a bit of an amorphous answer, because you could say, well, that covers, you know, you've just covered a huge swath of companies in the U.S. But I think there is a little bit of a, you know it when you see it here. I mean, you know what are the deals that are going to be on the front of the Wall Street Journal, and the administration is going to care about them, and therefore the agencies are going to care about them. And so you can kind of spot those deals usually coming from a mile away. And you know, in those cases, that it's going to be very important to kind of join up your narrative, your strategy, your antitrust process with your broader kind of GA and PA strategy for the deal, to just try to smooth the path as much as you can. You know, one thing that is, I would say, you know, gone in a better direction in this administration is that we have lost the Biden administration just sort of blunt hostility to businesses and companies. You know, one of the things that was very difficult in the M&A process during the Biden administration was that there was really just a distrust of corporate actors. This view that all M&A is bad, all companies are bad. And so the best thing the administration can do is slow M&A down and make it really difficult and painful. So you would see, you know, very prolonged second requests where parties are not allowed to comply. You saw early termination go away. You saw remedies go away. And all of that has sort of softened in this administration. So we have very smooth processes for unproblematic deals. Early termination is happening. It's not happening as fast as it used to, but it's happening. The agencies are negotiating remedies again. We're seeing what are called kind of quick look second requests again, where you don't fully comply. You just sort of do enough work to convince the agencies that there's not an issue. So there's a lot of kind of good pro-business things happening. And this is a kind of a good time to do M&A in the sense that some of those roadblocks are down. But as was always the case, you know, you're going to have a small handful of deals that are going to have a lot of these headwinds. And, you know, what you really need to do there is be as prepared as possible to deal with all of those. And that's, you know, it's your narrative, it's your GA strategy, it's your PA strategy. It's when am I engaging with which regulator at what time? You know, if this is a deal that's really important to UK national interests, do I want to let them go first so they can get everybody else on board? And none of that is sort of new. It's the, you know, the continuation of thinking about the policy aims with the antitrust that is, I think, the thing that continues to be not new there, but a continuation from what we started to see in Biden.
So, Jen, in this new world that we've kind of illustrated, where it's important to craft a global narrative, it's important to take on these other considerations. How does this align with the administration's agenda or either any country's agenda? What tools are at your disposal to do that, to craft that narrative, to get in front of the regulators and advocate for the benefits of this merger? I think a lot of us are looking at a number of examples and thinking, okay, there are some actors that we're not used to seeing that are now a part of the process. Can you tell us, and you know, pretty clearly, I'm asking about lobbying and advocacy in antitrust these days. And I know it's been around, and I know that effort has always been a part of the process, but it's looking a little different these days. And I'd like to understand from your perspective, when do those folks come in? When are they necessary? What is their role? What is their function? How is this kind of going down?
It is the question. You know, I think not a day goes by lately where I get a question from a company of, can't I just hire XYZ person and I can do whatever I want? And, you know, I will tell you that is not the world that we are living in. You know, I understand what folks are reading in the press. I understand where that question comes from. But, you know, we still live in a merits-based enforcement universe where you can't just, you know, hire up the right person and get a deal done that is otherwise problematic. You know, I've been involved in some of the deals where there's been this press. I've talked to lawyers that have been involved in others. And I think, you know, the real consistent story that I have heard and lived is that these are cases where a lobbyist is helping kind of unblock a process where otherwise the facts are on the party side. There is a very clear pro-competitive rationale for the deal. And earlier in my career, I would have told you that hiring a lobbyist, hiring kind of GA advisors is always going to make things more difficult and you should absolutely never do it. I think, you know, the world that we are in right now, probably that advice has shifted a little bit to you want to have these people to deploy if you need them, but you are still by far in a much better position if you can get the agencies on side and convince them on the facts. And, you know, a lobbyist is really only going to be able to help you if you have good facts and you have a very clear rationale as to why the right outcome is clearance or remedy or whatever it is. And they're just kind of helping procedurally to get to that correct outcome. You know, you can't just call up a lobbyist and say, this merger is blatantly anti-competitive, but I want to do it anyway. And the other thing I, you know, I would caution companies to think about here is that the federal government is just one piece of the puzzle here. And if you go down this path, you are potentially buying yourself a lot of pain because there are other players that are kind of marshaling their resources to make sure that we retain kind of legal-based, standard-based antitrust enforcement. You know, I think chief among those is state attorneys generals. You know, folks probably understand that we have a sort of strange system, honestly, in the U.S. where state AGs are not preempted from bringing antitrust enforcement actions just because the federal government has brought one. So just because your deal is reviewed by the FTC or the DOJ doesn't mean that a state can't investigate it and can't sue to block the entire transaction, not just the transaction in their space. You know, they are equal enforcers under Section 7 of the Clayton Act. Historically, that has actually been an area of cooperation. So state AGs were, you know, some were more active than others, but in general, they would piggyback off of FTC or DOJ challenges where there was a case that, you know, was very important to their constituents. So you would typically see state AG involvement in, you know, consumer goods, healthcare, things that are, you know, kind of bread and butter products that people are going to kind of talk about at the kitchen table. And the AGs would sort of join the DOJ and FTC investigation. They might be a party to the lawsuit. They might do some of the work behind the scenes, but it would typically be very aligned with what the federal government is doing. Now we are seeing the state AGs sort of building up their antitrust teams and some of them being very vocal about the fact that they are going to bring enforcement actions where they perceive the DOJ or the FTC to have sort of fallen down on the job. And I think they are styling themselves as sort of neutral good guy enforcers. But the truth is, where you're talking about Democratic state AGs, there's a political element to that as well. And so you can find yourself in a situation even within the U.S. where you have sort of these opposing forces investigating your deal. And you are, again, much better off if you've convinced everybody on the facts than if you're in the middle of this sort of political firestorm. And that's true with Congress as well, right? So, we have an election coming up this year. If Democrats take back part of Congress, we might see more congressional investigation into mergers that were cleared, into settlements, into conduct investigations. So, you know, just because you get through a DOJ or an FTC process isn't the end of the story. And, you know, a company really doesn't want to see itself in a place where you're through, you know, DOJ, FTC review, you close your deal, and you want to focus on integrating, but instead you're focusing on other kind of investigations that are popping up in the U.S. Can't forget the U.S. ex-U.S. regulators there either, where geopolitics means there's less alignment between the U.S. agencies and other agencies than there historically has been. But you still have kind of historic ties and coordination. And so if the U.S. were to kind of clear a deal and the EU and the U.K. still think it's a problem, they're not going to feel as beholden to just follow that decision as you know, you kind of might have seen historically there, where there was more alignment and coordination among the regulators. So, you know, I think the short answer to your question, Ruben, is number one, I think lobbyists maybe have a role now that they didn't historically have, but you have to use them very carefully. And I would advise to not use them if you can avoid it. And even if that helps unjam one problem, you know, it's like a hydra. Three others can pop up in its place. So you really have to think through the long-term implications.
Sure. That makes sense. And I appreciate you kind of unpacking all the different players that need to be accounted for here. I think you were saying this earlier on, but there was a world in which, okay, you convince one regulator that it's in the government's interest for this merger to proceed. And then there was kind of a default position that regulator will explain their thinking to their sister agencies abroad and champion your deal to some extent. I mean, that doesn't happen with every deal. I think I'm putting in simplistic terms, but it's my understanding that that was a dynamic that occurred historically. How much of that is still going on? If the Department of Justice says, yeah, we're going to bless this transaction, it's in line with our antitrust metrics and readings, and we think it's good for the country and our agenda, are they out there advocating with the CMA, with the EC and SAMR? Is there still that level of interaction and advocacy from the agencies themselves?
So I think that this really ties back to this kind of infusion of policy into antitrust. It's really the why of the lack of alignment that you are sometimes seeing here. If a case is one that is really being decided on your kind of traditional antitrust bread and butter consumer welfare metrics, you're looking at documents, you're looking at economics, you know, the reason that you used to have alignment is because everybody's using the same standard, everybody's looking at the same facts. And so unless you have different facts in a different country, then there's no reason why all the regulators shouldn't kind of come out in the same place. But if you have a deal now where there are local policy implications, that creates sort of more opportunity for divergence because, you know, the feeling about a deal's impact on labor in the U.S. might be different than, you know, the impact on ESG in the EU. So, you know, you can have competing policy goals. You can have different views of how policy goals should be achieved. And so that creates just a little more room for regulators to come to different outcomes and think about issues in different ways. So I think you do still see coordination. There's strong historic ties, but there is just maybe more room for a basis to come to a different conclusion. And I think, you know, we also just live in a time where there's maybe less respect between different countries. And so there's less of a feeling of, hey, we should all get on the same page and we don't really want to upset our friends and allies in this country or that country because we've made a deal for two EU companies or US companies or whatever. It is really difficult for, you know, kind of policy reasons. So, you know, there's just more space for that divergence than there was previously. And I think the solution to that again, is to have, first of all, kind of a global narrative that hangs together and that thinks about how different regulators are going to think about your deal and threads that needle as much as you can. And then there's also a sequencing question, because these regimes are different. Some regulators have an ability to just prohibit a deal with kind of very long appeal rights that effectively render your deal dead. You know, the US has to take deals to court, which is typically a faster process. So if you think you have a deal that might get sort of stuck in this process, thinking about who you sequence first is important, because you don't want one regulator to sort of leverage another process to try to get a deal blocked if they're in a world where it's hard for them to do it themselves. It is, I think I've said this my whole career, that it's important to have globally joined up counsel. I think it has only gotten more and more and more important. And now it's almost to the point of negligence if you're not, you know, kind of thinking about your deal with a globally joined up team who is looking across all of these key regulators and trying to come up with a cohesive global strategy.
Jen, it strikes me that so much of our conversation has been talking about these external forces that are somewhat new or kind of rising in prominence that are making the process more and more complicated. And it seems to me that a lot of your counsel has been bring it back to basics. You know, like, yes, we have to account for all these, but it's the merits of the transaction. It's doing things right and trying to kind of hive off introducing these externalities that are going to make it increasingly complicated. That's kind of a different role than we've seen antitrust attorneys play in the past, where it was somewhat surgical. It seems like the world that we're living in and the counsel that you're having to provide is much broader in scope. Is that accurate? And does that reflect the antitrust bar's thinking, or is this kind of a unique approach that you all are taking at Freshfields? How are you seeing your peers react? How are you seeing the movement of the antitrust bar and their ability to kind of keep pace with this changing world?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I don't know that I would describe it so much as a shift, this kind of back to basics idea. I think to me, the point is that it has always been the case that you want to convince the agencies on the merits. It is still the case that you want to convince the agencies on the merits. That's the best possible position to be in. And maybe, you know, some of the stories that you tell as part of those merits have shifted a little bit. But ultimately, you know, you, your company, your deal are in a much better position if you are sort of below the fray, talking about the antitrust, you know, dealing with the agencies in the way that companies have always dealt with the agencies, and not, you know, in the press. You know, I think that's exactly how you articulate those arguments shifts. But, you know, the advice to sort of work through the process is not different. And I think, you know, some of the folks at the agencies have been pretty vocal about that as well. You know, I wouldn't purport to speak for the entire antitrust bar. I know this is a view that is shared by a lot of folks. I think, you know, when I talk to others in the bar, what I hear is really, in some ways, just a little bit of uncertainty on how to handle this moment, right? Because it used to be that the very consistent counsel you saw from law firms was, lobbying is not going to help you here. Governmental affairs is not going to help you here. And with, you know, press we've seen, decisions we've seen, you know, that is a complicated discussion with clients and with companies, because, you know, with every case, the facts are different, the circumstances are different. And so there's not a one size fits all answer here. But I still think that you are in the best possible position you can be in if you have a strong case on the merits.
Let me ask you a question that can be open-ended, and this will be our final question, Jen, but I want to understand what may keep premier antitrust counsel up at night. Is there something that has not emerged in the processes we've seen over the last year or so that may be coming down the pike that needs to be guarded against or otherwise insulated to some degree?
first of all, it's important to keep in mind that, you know, when we're talking about these cases, you know, with really challenging antitrust issues, that those are a very, very tiny fraction of deals. And, you know, companies doing M&A should remember that the overwhelming majority of transactions are being cleared by the agencies without a second request, without remedies, without litigation. And so in some sense, my counsel to clients most of the time is put your head down, go through the process, and, you know, if we have an issue, convince on the merits, and we go through. For those deals that are very challenging globally in the US, however, you know, however it shakes out in the facts of a particular case, you know, I think honestly, we have really touched on the piece of this that keeps me up the night that keeps me up at night the most, which is how will the DOJ and FTC processes interplay with both other regulators around the world, but also other forces within the US, like the state attorney generals, like client, like the state attorneys general, like Congress, because that is a piece of this process that has the potential to rear its head long after a deal has closed. And I think, you know, thinking through how what you do now might kind of live in the memories of those folks and pop up tomorrow is something that companies have to be thinking about in this moment. And you have to be setting your strategy in a way that is cognizant of it. And, you know, not to be kind of a broken record here, but to me, that's why it really comes back to, across all of those forces, you are in the best possible position that you can be in if your case has been strong and on the merits, and if you convince the agencies that there's not a problem and the facts are on your side, because that should be sufficient to convince all of these other players. And so that's always where I go back to. And, you know, you may have kind of other noise around the edges, but that is, for if I were a company and for my clients, that's where I want them to be at the end of the day.
Jen, this has been fascinating. A view from the trenches. I can't thank you enough for coming on with us today.
That was Jen Mellott, the managing partner of Freshfields in Washington, speaking to Merger Markets Global Chief Regulatory Editor Ruben Miller. And just to point out, this episode was recorded on Wednesday, the 4th of February. Thanks for listening to this episode of Dealcast from Merger Market. I'm Juliana Needham. To find out more about what we've been talking about on this episode, have a look at our show notes. Join us again next week.